Adelina do her job. He flashed Adelina an impish grin, his strange eyes flashing. She returned a nervous smile with a slight blush.
Very well, Shade conceded. Don't blame me when they lock you in some magical trap room.
They're not going to lock me in a magical trap room, Jason said. Why would they even have a magical trap room?
It's for monsters that can move through the ground, Adelina volunteered. The walls are magically reinforced, but we don't have good attacking options inside the ground, so we open a gap in the defences and lure them into a trap room.
Adelina, Kerr said. Why are you explaining the fort's defences to this stranger? Her eyes went wide and she gulped. Perhaps you should go back down and try the magical sensors again.
Yes, sir, she said,
scurrying back down the stairs. You really do have a magical trap room? Jason asked. Is there a trap door over it? Shade, does this world have rancors?
There is a bipedal lizard with an ogre bloodline that is quite similar.
How does a lizard get an ogre bloodline? Jason asked. On second thought, don't tell me. The answer will be weird and gross. Adelina returned from downstairs, reporting to Kerr once again.
He's not human, sir, but whatever he is, it's what he appears to be.
Should I feel violated? Jason asked. Make a gap in the wall to let Mr. Asano through, Kerr instructed Adelina.
Yes, sir.
She flashed Jason a glance as she headed back for the stairs. Luis led Jason to a storeroom where he unloaded all the supplies from Rimuros. Along with crates of spirit coins, the delivery was primarily replacement parts for the town's magical defences. Powerful protective systems like the Force Barrier, the magically reinforced walls, and the Windblade runes took concentrated, heavy-duty magic. Rather than spirit coins, this meant mana accumulators, much like the one Jason had used to maintain his Cloud House's functions on Earth. They were far cheaper than the Cloud Flask, of course, which was exotic even in Rimuros, so they burned out over time. The spirit coins were to keep the essence users in the fort fed, as well as maintaining the less intensive magical amenities like lamps, plumbing, and air filters. Jason hadn't brought any regular food, only magical supplies, since the food came from the dedicated food farms scattered around. Jason was looking forward to seeing one in operation, which he would at his next delivery stop. After checking the supplies against their respective lists and making sure everything had arrived, Luis took Jason to Kerr's office, the commander wanting to speak with the adventurer. He sent Jason in as Miranda was just coming out.
What do you think?
Luis asked Miranda in a half whisper as the door closed behind her.
About what?
Miranda asked.
About Asano,
Luis clarified as the pair started walking away.
What was that stuff about the diamond ranker? He was just talking nonsense. If he went mouthing off at a diamond ranker, he really would be dead. I think Adelina might like him. Nothing gets past you, does it? But why? He's an evil weirdo, and when he talks to himself, something talks back. Now you're just looking for things. It's obviously a familiar, you're not that dense.
I still think it's odd that she'd like him.
Of course it's odd, Miranda said. What woman was ever attracted to a powerful and mysterious stranger?
Wait, you don't like him too, right?
Of course not. He's an evil weirdo.
Jason took a chair in the small office at Kerr's inviting gesture.
That was a deft, if rather unusual, approach to putting my people at ease, Mr. Asano.
I've found it's often better strange than scary, Jason said.
Unless scary is what you're looking for.
I'm done looking for scary.
Scary may not be done looking for you. Why did the Adventure Society send a guild member with their supplies?
I'm not in a guild, Jason said.
You're not?
Not yet. I'm going to join the same one as my team, but some unusual circumstances have left me here, on the far side of the world. I'm trying to get back to them, or get them back to me, whichever works. It's tricky during a monster surge, as I'm sure you can imagine.
The Adventure Society likes people to stay put and work hard.
As well they should, Jason said.
Even so, you're definitely at a guild level of bringing boots and ass together. Why would they send someone like you out here on a delivery run?
There are reports of pirates targeting the supply ships, Jason said. They've been loading the ships with some heavier hitters to try and catch them out.
I see. I assume you were told that you need to take our next supply request back to Rimuros.
I was.
Good. Luis will have that for you promptly. I was also hoping to presume upon you to deliver a package for me to a friend in Rimuros. Mail is hardly reliable at the moment, and even if the fort had a water-link chamber, the service congestion in Rimuros is quite heavy. The Adventure Society has taken control of all the water-link services for the duration, or so I'm told. What do you want me to take? I don't like putting mysterious packages into my storage space. Just a letter and a recording crystal. It wouldn't be a recording of the fight I just had, would it?
It would.
This favour will not disadvantage you, Mr. Asano. My friend is not placed in the very highest reaches of society, but he's respected. More importantly, he has a lot of friends of his own, many of whom are in the highest reaches of society. He's a good man to know and a better one to be known by, especially for an out-of-town adventurer without a lot of local connections. I'm not sure I like the kind of local connections I've been making thus far, but all right, Commander Kerr, I'm already playing delivery boy, so why not mailman as well?
Chapter 29. Going Overland. Outside of the rocky gorge, the coastal landscape was filled with greenery, white sand and blue water. Jason stood on a hilltop, looking out at a gorgeous beach and the sea stretching beyond it. Next to him stood his familiars. Shade had once preferred a shape akin to Jason in his cloak, but now looked more like the silhouette of a butler. Colin was in a humanoid form, the leeches that made up his body having melded together into what looked like a blood clone of Jason himself. Gordon was the most alien, being a nebula draped in a cloak, surrounded by floating orbs.
"This is the life," Jason said. "Setting out together to have some adventures, no worlds to save, no gold rankers to fight, and no vampire uprisings."
"Mr. Asano," Shade said, "while I am loath to dampen your enthusiasm, I feel obliged to remind you that you do still need to anchor the bridge that will stabilize the other world over time."
"The magic's too messed up right now," Jason said. "There's no way I get that right until the monster surge is over. That makes it a tomorrow problem. Today, our problem is where to stock up on local snacks for our tropical paradise road trip."
Jason had dropped off the airship over the coast of what was, in his world, Honduras. He would need to make his way south through Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Panama to make his deliveries before portaling back to Rimuros. He wasn't sure how close the geography and climate would be to Earth's, lacking familiarity with Central America in either universe. He anticipated fewer resorts. They were not far from the Arcazatlan Fortress. Shade had taken the form of a land skimmer to carry Jason along the road out of the gorge on a smooth cushion of air. The road was part of a well-maintained network running through the jungles and hills, although he had stopped shortly into the journey to take in the panorama as the road crested a hill. He had called out his familiars to share the moment with him, although he had no idea if any of them appreciated sightseeing as a pastime. Jason slapped Colin on the back.
"What do you say, blokes? Get moving?"
"Very good, Mr. Asano."
Shade was the only one able to speak, but the others had their own means of communication. Gordon lit up one of his orbs with blue light, meaning yes. Blood clone Colin opened his mouth and let out a noise that sounded like it rumbled up from the darkest pits of hell.
"I know you're hungry," Jason said.
"You're always hungry.
It's kind of your thing."
Colin opened his mouth again, this time releasing the shriek of a soul being dragged to damnation.
"Yes, I know the Bone Feasters were skinny, but at least there were a lot of them. We'll find someone for you to eat along the way. Would you like a sandwich?"
Colin's response was a quiet, eerie sound, like wind whispering through a graveyard.
"Fine. A big sandwich."
Jason could have moved faster than his current travel speed by having Shade take the form of a flying vehicle. He was certainly interested in the local equivalents of planes, which he hadn't seen any of yet. They were magical constructs built in the shape of flying creatures, and were typically private vehicles for wealthy families and high-ranking adventurers. Compared to airships, flying constructs were smaller and far less efficient in terms of capacity to cost, both for passengers and cargo. Jason appreciated the two advantages they had, though, which were speed and being giant robot birds. He would be willing to give up the speed. The airship that had carried Jason away from Rimuros had not been travelling at its maximum speed. One of the things Jason had learned while talking with the airship crew was that any magical vehicle became exponentially easier to detect the faster it moved. During a monster surge, full speed ahead was a recipe for disaster. It was probably why he had primarily seen ponderous airships rather than smaller, swifter flying constructs. Since he wasn't going to have Shade rocket him across the sky, Jason took the approach that had been recommended by the Adventure Society, which was to stick to the roads and follow the route he'd been given. He was allowed to take whatever pathway he wanted, so long as he met his delivery deadlines, but for once, Jason decided on the path more travelled. He followed the roads using the land skimmer, which was more or less a hovercraft. Jason was familiar with the vehicle type from his time in Greenstone. He'd ridden skimmers specialised for navigating wetlands and sandy desert, both of which were quite like airboats in their construction and operation. Shade took a more heavy-duty form that resembled a large, open-top car. It reminded Jason of a land speeder from Star Wars if the props guy only had black paint. Rather than pushing air out the back for propulsion, like the vehicles he was familiar with, this one moved through silent magic. Shade's ability to take on the form of transportation was much stronger at Silver Rank, meaning he could replicate more magically sophisticated vehicles. This was especially true when not working with Greenstone's limited ambient magic. The forms Shade took were unable to mimic the weapons and defensive properties of similar forms of transport, with limited exceptions such as creatures with bladed arms or the impact bars of a vehicle. Even then, there was a fragility to such features that made them useful for little more than clearing rough terrain. The only means Shade had to improve the defensive power of these forms was for Jason to share his cloak power with each of the bodies Shade used to construct the form. This could be relatively mana-intensive, such as when Jason shared enough cloaks for Shade to create several passenger buses. That was during the Battle of Broken Hill, where many civilians required evacuating, and there were more than enough monsters to drain. "Going overland is better anyway," Jason explained, sitting in the back seat. One of Shade's bodies was pointlessly in the driver's position, with Gordon floating over the seat next to him. Colin was in the back, Jason's first familiar getting to sit next to him. "Every time some open-world game puts in flying mounts," Jason continued, "it's more convenient, but also more boring. Plus, you miss out on all the awesome stuff you just fly over without ever getting to see."
"Mr. Asano, I don't believe any of us have played a video game."
"Gordon gave it a go, bless him," Jason said. "I had to buy Emmy a new controller. Having beams of destructive force instead of hands isn't super convenient." The empty hood of Gordon's cloak dipped sadly. "Don't worry about it, mate. How about we let you pick the music?" Jason pulled out his recording crystal stand, which was a series of rotating trays on a central shaft with a handle at the top. Each time he tapped a finger to a compartment, it projected a listing of what the crystal inside had recorded on it. "I need to get an artificer to make some kind of music player," he mused. "Something I can slot all these into and make some playlists." "So what are you thinking, Gordon? The Doors?" An orb glowed orange, a negative response. "Beach Boys? Could be just right for a road trip along sandy shores?" Orange glow. "The Hollies? A bit of long, cool woman in a black dress?" Orange orb. Jason tapped a finger to his lips thoughtfully. "Okay, I think I've got it. Marlena Shaw." All of Gordon's orbs lit up blue, and Jason laughed. He took out a small crystal projector and leaned over the front seats to rest it on the dashboard. Jason missed the amenities of a car, like a music system, but not enough to get Shade to take a car form. Shade had never so much as suggested it, knowing Jason wanted to put Earth and its problems behind him. Jason could have stealthed his way south. Even using Shade as transport, the familiar retained his ability to mask Jason from various forms of detection. Instead, he and his familiars were riding in the open-top vehicle along an empty road, California Soul blasting out of the crystal projector. He wasn't going to reach gold rank hiding from monsters. The Surge would be his last chance to see them en masse for a while. Ever since leaving Greenstone to spend months in an astral space, Jason had no shortage of readily accessible monsters. The astral space itself, then the proto-spaces of Earth, the monster waves, and the transformation zones. For all the misery and tribulations he had been through, raising his rank at an impressive pace had never been an issue. Jason had checked on his team status at the Adventure Society, and they had all ranked up fairly recently. Even with the boost to advancement speed that humans enjoyed, Jason had beat out Humphrey and Clive by a good margin. After going through Iron Rank at a sedate pace, Jason had raced through Bronze. Now Jason was in a more normalized space and had hit the grind wall on the long path to gold. Once the monster surge was over, it would take years to make real progress. Even so, he wasn't sad about that fact. After what he'd been through, he was ready to slow down, if only events would let him. That wouldn't stop him from making the most of the monster surge while it lasted, though. The most disappointing part of the trip turned out to be the lack of people. The coast was dotted with abandoned towns and villages, the citizens having evacuated to fortress towns or one of the local cities. None of the cities could match the size of Rimuros and lacked the resources to supply the forts with all their needs. This was where Jason and adventurers like him came into play. Without people around, Jason was able to extend his senses to their full reach, the way he couldn't in a city. Mostly, he just sensed herd animals that hadn't been taken away. They'd been set loose outside the towns in hope of drawing monsters from the empty infrastructure. People were hoping to come home without some wandering monster having trashed it. The roads were excellent, but the lack of other traffic was a little unnerving. Like the empty towns and villages, it reminded Jason unpleasantly of Earth when all the rural areas had been abandoned for the safe zones. He stopped regularly to hunt packs of silver rank monsters. Once he detected a gold rank one at the periphery of his perceptual range and withdrew his senses sharply. He turned down the music and slowed the skimmer to a crawl. Fortunately, the monster either didn't sense him or was one of the blessedly non-aggressive types. He marked the location on his map ability to share with the Adventure Society anyway. Gold rank monsters could live for decades or even centuries before their bodies broke down, sending them berserk. As such, the Adventure Society often left the non-aggressive varieties alone while keeping track of their location and age. Arriving in one of the small cities, Castistus, Jason was happy to see people again. He was far more thoroughly examined at the gate than he was at Arcazatlan Fort, from magical scans to checking and rechecking his contract documentation. "You all seem a bit jumpy," Jason mentioned to a guard as she scanned his body with a fourth device. "Something happen?"
"A vampire got in with a big batch of refugees," she told him. "Turned about a dozen people before we caught on. Those evacuation accommodations aren't set up for pitched battle, and things got bloody. We lost a lot of people, refugees and city guard both. Now we check everyone, adventurers, nobility, it doesn't matter."
"That's fair," Jason said. "And I'm sorry. I can see why you'd be careful." She let out an unhappy snort.
"If you could maybe share that attitude with your adventurer friends, that would be nice."
"I'll do my best. Not a local, though, so no promises." Jason didn't want to linger in the city. It was massively overcrowded from all the people taking shelter, which he had no intention of adding to. He would report the gold rank monster he sensed and then get back on the road. The guards told him that personal flight was allowed, but vehicular flight required a permit. So advised, Jason set out across the city using his cloak wings, although their mana cost was greater when used in the sunlight. He wouldn't be able to take any detours unless he wanted to drop down to ground level and rest, but the city held nothing that seized his interest. The city was pleasant enough, especially seen from above, but was rather unremarkable. Compared to Rimuros and its sky islands, Castistus was small and lacked attention-grabbing features. It was just inland enough to be sheltered by hills, which was valuable in the Sea of Storms. The buildings were low and widely spaced, with plenty of greenery. If not for the swarms of people, it would have been open and inviting. Jason reined in his aura once more in the populated area, Relying on the directions the guards had given him, he swiftly made his way to the Adventure Society office, picking up the auras of the local adventurers as he drew close. He felt perceptions passing over him as well, and he modulated his aura to seem capable but not elite. This matched most of the auras he sensed around him. Jason's experience of adventurers came from two extreme ends of the spectrum. Greenstone and Earth represented the bottom of the adventurer barrel. The mediocre aura control of most of the essence users Jason had met all but screamed sloppy skills and little, if any, proper training. On the other side were individuals like Danielle Geller and Rufus Remore, as well as the adventurers of Rimuros. Even the adventurers assigned delivery duty in Rimuros would have been absolute elites in Greenstone. In Castistus, the adventurers fell somewhere in the middle. Based on their auras, their skills were respectable, but not enough to make it in the big city. Jason knew that many adventurers had gone to Rimuros for the Monster Surge, hoping to be recruited into a guild. The adventurers here apparently understood their level. There were a few auras that stood out, their aura control a definite cut above the rest. He felt a cluster close together, presumably a team. There was one gold rank aura present, which felt much akin to the mid-range auras that were the norm there, but polished by experience. The Adventure Society building was a three-story office without any attached buildings. Castistus was too small for a trade hall or even a dedicated building for the jobs hall. Jason landed out front and opened the doors just in time for a voice to come whining out of it.
"Do you know who my father is? You're courting death."
"Oh, great," he muttered under his breath. "There's a Thadwick." Chapter 30. Small. The lobby of the Adventure Society office was not large, even though it served double duty as the public face of the society and the jobs hall. About a dozen adventurers were standing around inside. Even this small branch was made busy by the Monster Surge. The team of silver rankers, whose auras marked them as a cut above the others, were present, looking with weary expressions at two other adventurers facing off. Jason had seen that expression before, on Neil's face when Thadwick was about to do something stupid. Given that the team watching was superior to both of them, they were likely babysitting one or the other through the surge. Jason guessed it was the loud one.
"I am Argrave Mediculato, son of Ramon Mediculato. You think you can talk to me like that?"
He was a Celestine with onyx hair and eyes and pale skin. His almost petulant expression made Jason peg him as genuinely young, not just preserved by his silver rank. As for the smugly derisive look on the other adventurer, it was embarrassingly familiar as well.
"Wait!"
Jason called out as he entered the lobby. He marched across the room.
"You're the son of Ramon Mericolato?"
The adventurer, who had been loudly proclaiming his family connections, turned to look at Jason.
"Who are you? Why are you interrupting me?"
"I apologize," Jason said obsequiously.
"I was just startled to learn that you're the son of Ramon Mericolato. He's an inspiration to me, to everyone, really. And even to meet his son is such an honor.
I apologize if I've disturbed you at all."
"See?"
Argrave said, turning back to the other adventurer.
"This is how you show respect."
"Don't bother with this man," Jason said. "Dealing with people who are small only serves to make you smaller. You need to be the bigger man, if only because you so very clearly are. People like him and me are beneath you. You have no need to bother with the likes of us." The idiot nodded at the praise, noticing neither the other adventurer opening his mouth to retort, nor the pinpoint blast of aura suppression that silenced him before he spoke.
"What's your name?"
Argrave asked Jason.
"Neil Devone,"
Jason said.
"It's an honor to be known to someone with such a prestigious background."
"It is," Argrave agreed, then turned to the elite silver team.
"We're leaving. This nonsense is beneath me."
Argrave marched out of the room, pushing both double doors open as he passed through. One of the elite team members flashed Jason a grateful look as they followed, closing the doors behind them. Jason released the aura suppression on the other adventurer, who looked like he could breathe again after being caught underwater.
"What was that?" he asked angrily. There were a handful of other adventurers standing around, watching the whole debacle.
Jason's slightly hunched stance and obsequious expression had vanished the moment the lobby doors closed. He gave the other adventurer a friendly smile.
"Sorry about that," Jason told him. "Why would someone who can do that suck up to that little toad?"
"It's like I told him," Jason said. "If you get involved with someone small, it only makes you small as well. Take it from someone who's been caught up in pettiness and been made petty himself for doing so. I've walked that road to the end, and it doesn't lead anywhere good."
"He's a smarmy little prick who doesn't know how to do anything other than trot out his family name."
"Yep," Jason agreed. "People like that are essentially high-maintenance pets. If you feed them a biscuit and leave them to their handlers, they're simple creatures and will wander off on their own. If you try to discipline them yourself, they won't stop barking, and sooner or later, you'll have to deal with the owner."
"You think I'm just going to accept you crushing my aura like that?"
"Yes," Jason said softly, the smile dropping from his face. "I do." Suddenly a sense of stillness came over the room that went beyond mere silence. The adventurers around them had a feeling that it was somehow related to an aura, but couldn't sense the aura responsible for the effect, leaving them unnerved.
"I think you're smart enough to take some advice from someone who has been where you are and made mistakes," Jason said, then held out his hand for the man to shake.
"I'm Jason Asano."
"Listen, Kit," the adventurer said, shaking Jason's hand. "Which one of us did you give the fake name?"
Jason flashed a grin.
"The name is real. I'm the fake part."
Jason reported the gold rank monster and got out of the city before he wound up in any trouble with entitled young adventurers and their more than capable entourages. Back in the land skimmer with his familiars, they saw more and more conjoining roads as they drew closer to an important transport hub. They passed several empty port towns, plus a large one that had the defences of a fortress town. It wasn't on Jason's delivery list, so he passed it by. Nearing the heart of the transport hub sector, Jason caught sight of an unusual building in the distance. A huge tower loomed over the jungle, allowing Jason to spot it long before the roadways brought him to it. It rivaled the skyscrapers of Earth for scale and was set out in the shape of an octagon. The walls featured large panels of dark green glass, set into stone blocks whose lighter shade of green was very familiar.
"Shade? Do those bricks look like the ones they export from Greenstone?"
"There is a striking resemblance, Mr. Asano."
"That's a long way to ship stone."
"The tower should be the magical farm of the Fertility Church," Shade said, "as the stone in question is valuable for the life and water affinities inherited from the astral space apertures around which the stone is quarried, it would make sense to be used for this purpose."
"I guess you don't spare the expense when you need to keep giant monsters away from the food supply," Jason said. "I was starting to think that I was rich, but it turns out that I'm only silver rank rich."
"Given that you are quite early on the path to gold, Mr. Asano, your fiscal gains have been respectable."
"Oh, I'm not complaining. I'm just seeing things like sky islands and skyscrapers made of magic stone shipped from the other side of the planet. It's becoming increasingly evident that this fish has found itself in a very large pond."
As the vehicle skimmed over the road towards the river, Jason sensed magical infrastructure. The road itself seemed to be some kind of magical conduit, part of a wide-scale mana accumulator feeding magic to the tower. Jason had seen something familiar in the past when Farah had used a similar setup to fuel the defences of Asano Village. They passed over large defensive formations embedded into the ground. Jason felt them sweep through the vehicle, his familiars, and himself with potent magic. It was a protective array stronger than anything he'd encountered before. Perhaps Emir's gold rank cloud palace could match it, but Jason's senses had not been advanced enough back then to compare. The magic wasn't hidden, but instead projected, to the point where even normal people might sense it. Any monster with even minor supernatural senses would easily detect the threat in time to flee. Jason recognized that the purpose was to deter monsters and save on the cost of activating the formidable protections. Jason pushed on, being very open with his aura as the magical arrays probed it. He could tell the defenses were designed for far greater dangers than he presented, and he didn't want any accidental misfires because he was playing games. Drawing close to the tower, the skimmer slowed to a stop in front of a bronze-rank elven woman in green robes, waiting for Jason's arrival. The robes were marked with a baby holding a grain stalk in each hand, the symbol of fertility. Gordon vanished into Jason's aura and Colin soaked into Jason's skin. Shade and the skimmer both disappeared into Jason's shadow. Jason stood up as the skimmer dissolved around him.
Are you the adventurer bearing our supplies?
I am. Jason Asano.
It is good to meet you. My name is Flo. I am unfamiliar with the House of Asano. Should I address you as Mr., Young Master, or Lord?
Lovely to meet you, Flo. My preference would be Jason, if that's not unduly informal.
Of course not, Jason. Would you please follow me?
The exterior of the tower had uniform windows of dark green glass, except for the bottom level and the two or three at the top. The ground floor had two doors set into each side of the building that Jason had seen, all heavy-duty metal engraved with protective sigils. Of the two doors per side, one was a large freight door and the other a normal-sized one. The priestess led Jason in through the closest of those. Inside, they followed one hall and then another until they arrived at an octagonal elevating platform shaft. She touched a crystal next to the shaft, and they waited for the platform to descend.
You're a few days ahead of schedule. That is much appreciated.
Although Jason felt like he was meandering, he had forgone the recommended method of stealthing carefully south while avoiding fights. Instead, he had lured in monsters, with the skimmer moving at a fast, but not too fast, pace. As a result, and even with stopping to fight, he was well ahead of the delivery deadlines he'd been assigned. It's a beautiful part of the world, Jason said. The wildlife is a little stroppy, but the scenery is amazing. I've been told that this isn't a highly coveted job, but I've been more than satisfied with the experience.
That is a good attitude to have, although perhaps not one that will serve the ambitious.
I'm almost aggressively unambitious, Jason said, before adding with a sullen mutter, for all the good it's done me. The priestess gave him an assessing look, but made no further comment. The elevating platform arrived from above and they stepped onto it. It carried them upward and the glass walls of the shaft gave Jason a good view of each story. Above the ground floor, every level they passed was a single giant room, each containing what looked like a vast and densely packed hydroponic garden.
This method of alchemical cultivation is a little resource intensive, thus the nutrient bath supplies we need on a regular basis, Floor explained. Outside of monster surges, it is not a cost-effective method of cultivation, and the alchemically focused orders of the church use these facilities for research purposes. During a surge, however, this methodology allows us to grow enough food for a very large amount of people in a small, secure space. With the Storm Kingdom's civic authorities offsetting the costs, we, of course, do our best for those isolated in the fortresses and cities.
I've seen similar techniques where I come from, although I've never seen it on a scale like this, Jason said. Those methods were non-magical, however, so the results here are no doubt more impressive. I imagine that accelerated growth rates are only the beginning of your achievements. There have been food shortage problems over the last few years where we could have used these techniques.
Are you speaking of another world?
You're familiar with Outworlders?
Familiar might be too strong a term, she said. I've encountered just one in the past. I believe there is another residing in Rimaros right now.
At least one, Jason said. They passed the third highest floor of the building, which was very different and looked like some kind of industrial plant. The platform stopped at the penultimate floor, and Floor led him out. This was a storage level that looked a lot like the supply depots in Rimaros.
The top three floors are service levels, Floor explained. The level below us contains the systems that deliver the resources stored on this level to the growing floors. We have a sorting area where you can deliver your supplies. The floor above contains the shrine, the living areas, and the coupling rooms.
Coupling rooms?
Would you like to see them? You'll need to go through some testing first, but you'll be absolved of all parental responsibilities, of course.
No, I'm good.
Are you sure? She asked, looking him up and down. I wouldn't mind.
Very sure. Thank you, though. She shook her head sadly.
They say men only think about one thing, she muttered. But show them one assertive woman and they shrivel up.
Hey, I love assertive women. Also, there's no shriveling going on here.
Of course not,
she said sympathetically. There isn't.
It's easy enough to prove.
You'll just have to take my word for it. Chapter 31 Uneasy Allies. So much for drawing away the defenders, Neil said, as the heavy land skimmer threaded a swift and dangerous path through the trees. In the driver's seat next to him, Belinda was concentrating on controlling the skimmer. The heavy combat skimmer procured specifically for this mission had full coverage armor and defensive weaponry. It was an advanced vehicle that only those with the right abilities could operate.
In fairness, Gary said, I haven't seen any purity priests, or anyone else alive for that matter. Just these things.
Racing through the forest, harrying the skimmer, was a crowd of centaur-like construct creatures. Built from dark wood and mottled iron, they were fast, powerful, and agile, perfectly suited to race through a forest. The bulk of the centaur constructs were bronze rank, with about 1 in 5 being silver. Palimaster centaurs had 2 heads, like Heidel's, even though the head was on the human part of the body. The constructs reflected this in their design. Some of the constructs had bows that conjured arrows when the string was drawn back and used them to pepper the skimmer with arrows. Others had spears and lances they used to attack the vehicle whenever they got close enough. The armor plating shielded the occupants, who were using open access panels to retaliate. Neil used his shield powers as enemies tried to stab through the panels, his burst shield power blasting away attackers. Belinda was using the vehicle's weapon system, a triangular column on the roof. There was a sigil on each of its 3 sides, each one capable of a different attack. One was an electricity attack that arced from enemy to enemy, while another blasted streams of fire. These first 2 attacks had not proved highly effective against the constructs, so Belinda didn't waste the energy. The 3rd option conjured heavy bolts with strong armor penetration, which dug into an enemy before exploding. They were proving much more effective, although Belinda tried not to overuse the weapon and drain the skimmer's energy. The main attackers were Gary and Kenneth, son of Brian, the 4th and final member of the group. Gary threw his hammer, which bounced from one construct to the next, chaining through the centaurs before flying back to his hand. Each hit came with a resonating force explosion, tailor-made for destroying constructs. Gary's hammer was specialized for fighting constructs, being the silver rank variant of a weapon he made for himself following Farah's death. It was enough to take out the bronze rank centaurs in 1 hit, but not the silvers. Still, it inflicted significant damage and sent them tumbling into other galloping constructs. Kenneth likewise worked on thinning out the bronze rankers, but most focused on slowing down the silvers. One of his special attacks involved a conjured harpoon that he threw into enemies, prioritizing the silver rank constructs. Once buried in a target, more harpoons were conjured around it, launching themselves at the centaurs nearby. The secondary harpoons were connected to the initial target by magical ropes that dragged the subsequent targets. They all crashed into the first, binding them together in an awkward bundle. Bound up, the centaurs were stuck trying to fight their way free from one another, inflicting mutual damage even as they were left behind by the rolling combat. Ken had the skirmish confluence, which made him very useful in this kind of running battle. Many of his powers could trip up the enemy, literally and figuratively, keeping the skimmer from being overwhelmed by the huge herd of constructs. Leaving the destruction of the bronze rank constructs to Gary's powerful attacks, Ken concentrated on stalling the silver rank centaurs with trip lines and net traps. I thought Purity and the Builder were meant to be uneasy allies, Humphrey shouted from the roof of the skimmer as it raced through a gulch. If this many construct creatures are protecting the dam, it would seem we were wrong.
Making too many assumptions or not enough information is a poor pathway to knowledge,
Clive yelled back. I'm not sure we should have let Sophie go off alone.
At her? Humphrey asked.
Since when does she wait for anyone's permission for anything?
Is she going to be all right back there?
Of course, Humphrey said proudly. The centaur herd bunched together as they followed the skimmer into the narrow gulch, which was exactly what Humphrey wanted. He ignored the arrows bouncing off his dragon armor since they all came from bronze rank constructs. Sophie was nowhere to be seen. She had left the skimmer long ago to stall the silver rank ones. As the lance-wielding centaurs thundered towards the rear of the skimmer, Humphrey stepped off, landing heavily in their path. The huge sword in his hands was in the shape of a dragon wing with rainbow scales. The blade was wreathed in fire. Humphrey stood his ground as the centaurs bore down on him in tight formation, shoulder to shoulder, lances out. The centaurs might only have been bronze rank, but charging attacks were their specialty, and their weapons had greater reach than even Humphrey's huge sword. Dragon wings manifested on Humphrey's back and reached around him to form a wedge against the onrushing weapons, which were deflected away at an angle. The wings immediately swept back to reveal Humphrey already swinging his sword in a huge horizontal arc. The sword smashed through the tightly packed front row of centaurs, without slowing, passing through wood and steel like a hot train through butter. The centaurs all but exploded from the force, flames from the burning blade spreading to many of the scattering chunks, raining down as burning debris. That was not even the end of the attack. A wave of fire and another of force were sent hurtling along the gulch by the swing of Humphrey's sword. It wasn't as destructive as the original attack, but still toppled the charging bronze rank constructs like bowling pins. Humphrey leapt high into the air with his silver rank strength, and with a powerful sweep of his wings, propelled himself forward. He swooped over the gulch, opening his mouth to breathe fire like a flamethrower, blanketing the centaurs still pursuing the skimmer. Unlike the flames from the skimmer weapons, the fire from Humphrey's powers had an extreme effect on the constructs. The silver rank effect of his aura, Dragon's Might, transformed any flames created by his abilities from ordinary fire into dragon fire. Dragon fire was far more effective against any kind of flame resistance, from protective magic to flame retardant materials. Wood quickly turned to ash, and steel melted away as the silver rank flames ravaged the bronze rank constructs. Even the rocks were on fire, cracking and melting. In the wake of Humphrey's sweeping flight over the gulch, all that remained was burning wreckage, scorched earth, and dark smoke rising into the air. More constructs charged out of the forest and into the gulch. Humphrey turned to look for the skimmer, about to vanish into the woods again. Deciding that he'd bought it enough time, he teleported onto its roof before it moved out of sight. Despite the construct centaurs moving through the trees in a tight herd, Sophie had no problems moving amongst them. If anything, it made her harder to hit with lances and bows, which were not designed for close-quarter fighting. So long as she avoided being trampled, she was fine. She wafted through the herd like a breeze, graceful and untouched. Even when it seemed like she was struck by a charging construct, she wasn't, the very concept of distance bending to her will. She ignored the weaker centaurs, knowing that Humphrey would turn them to piles of molten scrap. Sophie's biggest weakness was that she lacked the capacity to inflict decisive damage, whether up front, like Humphrey, or building over time, like Jason. She did have powers that could land the occasional big, singular hit, but it required setup, timing, and usually team cooperation to make the most of those opportunities. She mostly tackled her low damage problem by relying on her greatest strengths, speed and precision. Sophie's damage was small, but she inflicted both resonating force and disruptive force with every hit. That meant that whatever armor or magical barriers were in place, what damage she did do couldn't be shrugged off. By hammering away with every part of her body, she could rain down attacks at a blinding pace. She was too fast to stop and too elusive to pin down. The other key aspect of Sophie's approach was precision. Her attacks did not grow in power with ranks anywhere near as fast as the resilience of enemies did, so she needed to make every hit count. An ogre was incredibly tough. The side of its knee, however, not as much. Centaurs, as a construct design, had clear strengths and weaknesses. Their speed and charging power gave their attacks incredible impact damage, allowing even the bronze rank variants to pose at least some threat to silver rankers. Their weakness stemmed from their horse-like bodies. Against a small and agile enemy fighting up close, their size and inability to quickly turn hurt them badly. Their designs gave them more flexibility than an actual horse, but it only ameliorated the problem rather than solving it. Normally, this was not an issue while the constructs were moving at a gallop, as they were in pursuit of the skimmer. To Sophie, however, the pace of the centaurs was inadequate to deserve the word speed. Moving backwards or sideways, even throwing out rapid attacks, she could easily outpace both their movement and their reflexes. She danced around the charging constructs as if they were standing still. The other flaw in their horse-like bodies was that damage to their legs could be crippling. Sophie took full advantage of this by pounding on the legs with attack after attack. If the constructs had been actual centaurs instead of unfeeling automatons, they would have been frustrated at their inability to swat the fly buzzing around them. Compared to the brutal, fiery cataclysm Humphrey unleashed in the gulch, Sophie could have easily gone unnoticed by someone watching the herd pass by. Her attacks were pinpoint and her attitude methodical, hobbling one construct after another with the diligence of a tradesperson making their way through the tasks of the day. One by one, the silver rank constructs were crippled and left behind. The constructs didn't have a key advantage that living silver rank things did, the ability to rapidly heal. While some constructs had such abilities, they tended to be expensive, custom works. These centaurs were mass-produced models. Their main advantage was numerical. With the silver rank constructs either disabled or critically slowed, Sophie turned her attention to joining Clive and Humphrey. Before she left, though, she decided to thin out some of the weaker constructs while she was at it. She'd already followed the herd to a gulch where she could tell Humphrey had been to work with the smoke rising out of it. It seemed like the best place to drive the herd together. Sophie's wind blade power was something of an outlier amongst her other abilities. It was ranged rather than melee, a direct magical attack, and when she drew on the higher rank effects, quite mana hungry. One of Sophie's greatest strengths was that her abilities were mana efficient and her mana regeneration was strong. This played into the natural gift that Celestine shared that made all their abilities more mana efficient. Windblade, even pulling out all the high rank stops, didn't have a massive impact on enemies her own level. For clearing out a bunch of bronze ranks, though, it was up to the task. First, she needed to reposition, so she launched herself into the air with a blast of wind. She then shot forward, flying much faster than Jason or Humphrey could with their respective flight abilities. She arrived at the far end of the gulch, centaurs bearing down. Landing in their path, Sophie swept a long horizontal kick that produced a blade of wind in the direction of the constructs. She could modulate the nature of the blades depending on the gesture she created with them. Her long motion resulted in a long, slow-moving blade compared to a short, quick one. As of bronze rank, the blades grew wider as they traveled. The wider the initial blade, the faster it extended. By the time it reached the onrushing centaurs, the blade had become a long but thin wave, like a huge scimitar, stretching across the span of the gulch. Many monsters and any essence user could have easily avoided it, but the centaurs were charging in tight formation. Sophie had launched second, third, and fourth blades by the time the first struck. Every part of a wind blade that hit a centaur exploded into a secondary explosion, circles of cutting force like the rings of a planet. It would have looked familiar to Jason. The windblade runes of the Arkazatlan fortress had much the same effect. Multiple blade waves devastated the charging constructs. Although Sophie could not match the apocalyptic force with which Humphrey had left the gulch a smoking scrapyard, only the low rank of her enemies allowed her to partly mirror his success. Satisfied with her work, she launched into the air again and chased after the skimmer. "Thank you for answering my questions on reproductive techniques," Jason said to the priestess as darkness emerged from his shadow to take the form of a land skimmer.
"I think you should be open to more practical instruction."
"Once again, I'm just looking for information, but thank you for the repeated offers." In the outer reaches of the Sea of Storms, three invisible people moved through the air, over the road network cutting through the jungle. They matched pace with an open-top land skimmer full of strange figures.
"That man is very strange," one of the people said, his voice male.
A privacy screen shrouded his words from outside ears.
He's just talking to his familiars, a female voice responded. Everyone talks to their familiars. There is no way he understands what that thing is saying. I understand what my dog tries to tell me, and that's just an ordinary dog.
Your dog doesn't sound like it keeps tortured souls in a jar.
That's enough,
another female voice said. Her tone made it clear that she was the leader.
Stay focused. He may be silver rank, but his aura is strong and his senses are sharp. If he detects us, this whole trip goes to waste.
Chapter 32. Supply Chain Problems. The next fortress town Jason visited wasn't under active attack, which allowed him to get in and out quickly. Situated on the coast, it was connected to several storm accumulators. The offshore windmill-like devices collected power from magical weather events, for which the Sea of Storms was named. The prevalence of such storms in the local area was why an adventurer alone made the trip rather than an airship that could easily be caught up in the volatile weather. This particular town used the power it collected to charge mana batteries that other towns could use to power their defenses, reducing their reliance on the kind of long-distance deliveries that Jason was making. Jason's presence just added to local adventurers already delivering to surrounding areas. Jason handed over a fresh batch of empty batteries and collected charged ones to take to his next stop. One of the most isolated forts in the region, it was outside the range the local adventurers normally travelled. It would also be the last stop on Jason's route before returning to Rimaros. Far to the east of the forts being supplied by Jason was the fortress town of Carazella. One of the most outlying towns in the Storm Kingdom, its latest supply run was deeply overdue. The fort's defences had expired almost a week earlier, and if not for a visiting essence user, either of the previous two monster attacks could have overrun the town. As it was, several monsters made it over the walls and the fort's commander had lost people driving them back. The commander, Merrick Harlow, sat on the balustrade atop the wall, weariness engraved on his face like a sigil. He raised his head, offering a tired smile as someone joined him. Melody Jane was the essence user responsible for the fort lasting as long as it had without supplies. She had even made a run to the local fertility food tower after the last attack, saving the civilians from starvation. She had fought hard, and the stains and rents on her white leather armor told the story of the effort she'd expended in shielding the fort and its people. Unlike her irrevocably stained armor, her white hair and dark skin were clean. Water was the one resource they had no shortage of, and Melody liked to take showers. Merrick had no idea if she was a former adherent of purity or a loyalist. He was afraid to ask and didn't really care. Either way, she had an affection for cleanliness that he guessed was a long ingrained habit. He was certain that she hated wearing her marred armor, yet she always did, ever at the ready. Merrick looked at her white hair as she sat next to him, returning his tired smile with one of her own. She had cropped her hair short after a brutal head injury cut a good chunk of it away. The wound had healed, but she trimmed her lopsided hair to a short pixie cut. Melody gave Merrick a look filled with regret.
Merrick, I have bad news.
You're leaving, he said, his voice devoid of surprise.
I'm sorry.
I understand, he said. You've already done more than we had any right to ask.
I was hoping I could stay until new supplies arrived, but I have my own responsibilities. I've put them off as much as I could, more than I could, if I'm being honest.
Maybe those supplies will finally arrive before the next lot of monsters, he said, forcing optimism into his voice that he didn't feel.
We both know they won't,
Melody said softly.
I've heard things, and perhaps you have too. This isn't an ordinary monster surge. Some things are falling through the cracks. You and your people are one of them.
There's always hope.
She looked at him crestfallen.
I...
She trailed off, shaking her head.
What is it?
Merrick asked.
I can't say. I shouldn't.
He let out a laugh, heavy with resignation.
Miss Jane, Melody, everyone here is going to be dead in a week. You don't have to fear your secrets spilling out.
She hunched forward, looking at her feet as she shook her head again.
You're a good man, Merrick Harlow. A decent and diligent man who looks out for his people. You wouldn't damn them to save them.
He sat up straight.
Save them?
Melody continued to shake her head.
I only have one thing to give, Merrick, and you don't want it. Your people don't want it. I won't make them into pariahs.
What are you talking about?
Still hunched over, she turned to look at him.
You know what I'm talking about.
He looked away, running his hands over his face.
Purity, he said.
I know you haven't been asking because you were scared of the answer. Were you afraid that I'd leave, or that you would have to make me?
Either, both. So you're still?
Yes, she said. It's unwise to wear the symbols in these times, but the faith remains.
She stood up.
I'll go.
Wait,
Merrick said, gently grabbing her forearm before snatching his hand away.
Sorry.
He stepped back. She turned around with a beaming smile, placing her hand on his forearm.
You'll never have to apologize to me, Merrick. I've watched you give your all for the people here. You could take your strongest and make a break for safety, but that never even crossed your mind. I have nothing but admiration for you.
He bowed his head.
Do you have a way?
He asked, his voice barely audible.
A way to save them?
I can't recharge the fort's defenses, Merrick. The power I have to offer becomes part of the people who claim it, forever. It can't be given back, and it comes at a price.
What kind of power? And what kind of price?
I don't think you should—
Tell me!
His words, loud and sharp, rang out across the wall. Sentries watching for monster attacks turned in their direction. Melody trailed her fingers down Merrick's arm and gently squeezed his hand.
I can't ask you to do this, she said.
I'm asking you.
She let go and turned away, bowing her head again. He reached out with a hesitant hand, pausing before touching it softly to her upper arm.
Melody, please. If you have a way to save my people.
I don't,
she said, without turning around.
Maybe, there's a way for them to save themselves. But I can't.
Please, Melody, I'm begging.
She slowly turned, bringing herself close to Merrick with a half step.
What do you know about the Church of Purity? She whispered. Do you have any idea of what you're asking?
I'm asking for help.
I belong to a group, she said. An order. The Order of Redeeming Light. Have you heard of it?
No.
We take the things that are unclean, impure. We purify them, turn them into clean weapons of righteousness against the very filth from which they came.
Like monsters.
They are the most pervasive impurity in this world.
You have some of these weapons of righteousness.
You've heard that my church is in league with the Builder.
I have, but I barely know what that means. We live simple lives out here away from important people and their problems.
The Builder is very bad. Our entire church has had to do things to see it cleansed, things that others can't understand or forgive. But the Builder has something it gives to its soldiers, something that makes them strong. My order has taken one of the things that produce this weapon and passed it through the purifying light of our redemption rituals. Now we can make people strong without tainting them, give this world a chance against the Builder.
But the world hates us. Anyone who takes that power will be an outcast.
Better outcast than corpses, Merrick said.
What is this weapon?
It's called a redeemed core. If you give it to an essence user, they lose their powers, but gain new ones. More importantly, they gain an entire rank immediately.
An entire rank?
It won't work on gold rankers.
But on silvers,
it will take them to gold rank.
Merrick took a step back, running his hands through his hair with a shocked expression. This is not a simple fix, Merrick, or some easy path to power. There are consequences beyond how society will look at you. You give up all your essence abilities. You get new ones in return, but not as many. You won't be the equal of an adventurer of your new rank, but strong enough to fight monsters. Yes, but there is another price as well. And what is that? Faith. The taint of the Builder is gone, but the new power has to come from somewhere. From your god. Yes. You must open your heart and your soul to purity without reservation, or his power cannot flow into you. You cannot toy with divine power. I've seen what happens to those who try to claim this power with a deceitful heart. They become powerful, but also mindless. Simpletons who know only how to obey and not to think. I would rather someone be honest and turn from my god than go through that.
I can worship your god. If he gives me the strength to save my people, he deserves my faith.
Melody looked around, wary of the sentries who might overhear. She moved closer to Merrick again, speaking in a whisper as she rested a hand on his chest.
It's not that simple, Merrick. I've already told you more than I should, more than I'm allowed. I see you. I see your courage and dedication to these people. You are the kind of man this world should be celebrating, not leaving to his death.
Then give me this power.
I can't. If my people are going to expose themselves to help you, they have to know that you'll truly be with us.
What are you saying?
It can't just be you, Merrick. It must be all your silver and bronze people. If you want purity's help, you all have to make a show of faith together.
I can't tell my people to do that.
I know. This is why I didn't want to say anything at all.
Merrick walked away from Melody, back to the edge of the wall. He leaned on the balustrade, looking out over the sea. The breeze tousled his hair, the magical barrier over the fort long depleted.
It doesn't even have to be monsters at this point, he lamented. Without the magical barrier, even a storm could deal with us.
There might be something else, Melody said. If your people were willing to show their faith, then perhaps I can convince my people to help you in ways I cannot alone.
What kind of ways?
If you and your people take the power, it will take a little time for you to adjust. Days in which you won't be able to fend off monster attacks. But if my people knew they didn't have to fear you, we could stand for you until you are ready. Perhaps even share some of what supplies we do have. I can't promise anything on my own, but...
Merrick turned around to meet her gaze, eyes steely.
I can't tell my people to do this, he said, but I can ask.
Jason was riding along a wide jungle roadway when he sensed the approach of several people. He was passing by another fort town when four auras emerged and rushed towards him. They were essence users, three bronze and a silver. All had monster cores in their auras and were not adventurers. Shade pulled the skimmer to a stop. The vehicle and Jason's familiars disappeared, and he stood in the middle of the road to wait, letting them come to him. It did not take long, all sprinting up the connection road leading from the nearby fort town.
Adventurer,
the silver ranker said as they arrived. They had gone hard enough that the bronze rankers were exhausted from pushing themselves to match the silver's speed. I take it that you are residents of that fortress town? Jason said.
I'm the town commander. Are you a supply courier?
I am, but my supplies are not for your town.
Please,
the commander said.
Our courier is more than a week overdue. The food came from the fertility farm tower, but our remaining mana batteries won't hold out through another monster attack.
And if I give you the supplies for another, even more isolated town, what happens to them?
Please, I'm begging.
Jason frowned. I can't give you these supplies, he said. They were provided by another fortress town that charges mana batteries, though.
They have access to storm accumulators.
Yes.
Then you can leave your supplies here and go back for more. All we need are charged mana batteries.
I can't make that decision, Jason said.
But I've been there. I can portal you back to them, and you can plead your case for more supplies.
The commander's face lit up.
You have a portal power?
I do. We can go right now.
Standing in the open gates of the town, Merrick and Melody were facing one another, his hands clasped in hers.
Come back quickly, he said.
I will,
she told him with a smile.
With good news, I promise.
He reluctantly released her hands and she left, moving quickly, but stopping to look back more than once before she disappeared into the jungle. She picked up the pace until she was certain that she was beyond Merrick's aura senses. She slowed down, and soon after, two women in white armor appeared. One wore tough but flexible leathers like Melody, and handed her a fresh set from a dimensional bag. The other wore heavy armor made from the chitin of a monster, recolored white.
How did it go?
The leather wearer asked as Melody stripped off her dirty armor.
As planned, Melody said. All the silvers and bronze rankers.
The armored woman chuckled.
You're still the best, Mel. Should we let the next supply courier through? We killed too many and people might come looking.
No,